From KCRW in Santa Monica and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks show business is really all right life. Peaches and cream.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, Hollywood is notorious for being a challenging place to work. You may hear the raunchiest sex talk in the writer's room, or you might have to contend with an abusive tyrant on the set. Two lawyers debate what you have to put up with and what you don't if you're working in show business. But first, it's the Hollywood News Banter. Stay close. It's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
I'm joined in the studio by my fellow banterer, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So it's the kickoff of the summer box office derby. What do we got? What's on deck?
Smash-up derby is, I think, the better way to describe it. I mean, summer is the most important season for the movie studios, and this summer's no different. And it starts earlier. It starts this Thursday at midnight. I'm sure you'll be lining up to go see Iron Man 2.
Absolutely.
And then it just gets more crowded and more crowded. I mean, Iron Man 2, I think, if you believe the audience tracking surveys, could enjoy the biggest three-day opening in Hollywood history, beating even Dark Knight. But if it doesn't, it's got it's going to cut a huge swath, and then it's going to, create potential problems for Robin Hood and a lot of other movies that are in its wake.
Yeah, and Robin Hood, of course, is Universal's big hope to get out of its horrible slump, and it seems to be somewhat in the crosshairs of Iron Man.
No, and there's other bad news for Universal this week, and they have their first animated 3D movie called Despicable Me, and last week, Paramount decided to convert Airbender, the Night Shyamalan movie, into 3D, and that opens a week before Despicable Me. So I think Universal was hoping they would have pretty much free shot at all the 3D screens, and now Paramount has dropped a 3D movie right on top of them. So it's just been a couple of difficult years for Universal, and this is not going to help.
Of course, that 3D conversion trend continues with Airbender, which is another last-minute decision, which was so roundly condemned with Clash of the Titans. But nonetheless, Hollywood is going forward with that one. So,
I think the question going forward, and it's something that Jeffrey Katzenberg at DreamWorks has been adamant about, is he said Clash of the Titans was a horrible experience. And the question is, will moviegoers start to share that opinion? Will they start noticing the difference, as what Jeffrey says, between a real premium experience and a pretend premium experience? So this summer is not just a referendum on how big this movie season is going to be, but whether or not people are turned off by these late 3D conversions like Airbender.
We've talked about 3D in the past. We'll return to it again. Speaking of things that people return to again, the movie studios are developing another fascinating project based upon a toy, John. And I know that you're
This has global blockbuster written all over it. It's Paramount is developing, not yet making, a movie based on the Magic 8 Ball. You know, the one you turn over and it says, yes, depends, perhaps.
Ask later.
Exactly. I think there's some casting issues about who will play the 8 Ball.
Who will be the 8 Ball?
What I'd like to see happen is a week-long Hollywood toy and game festival. Universal is doing a movie version of Battleship. They also have Ouija Board, Clue, Candyland, Stretch Armstrong in development. Sony has Viewmaster and Risk. And I think if we can find somebody, maybe David Bergstein, to finance Yahtzee, Scrabble, and Pickup Sticks, we can have a whole week-long festival of
maybe a month,
fine
who knows?
Filmed entertainment. Maybe a month.
And I noticed the subtle mention of David Bergstein, a man in the news, or a man who's not in court but in the news. He is a guy who has financed a lot of movies that studios did not want to make, including some with some big stars, one of them being Nailed with Jake Gyllenhaal and Jessica Biel, a film that you haven't seen.
I just read a really interesting story about that. Kim, did you see that story?
I think I wrote that story in The Daily Beast, yes.
What you found.
I found that there are a slew of people who are claiming that they are owed money by this David Bergstein and that they have all gone to court. The bankruptcy court in L.A. has appointed an interim trustee to take control of the assets of this David Bergstein. And among the many creditors are the Screen Actors Guild, the Directors Guild, the Writers Guild. And that appears to be quite a mess in its own right. In addition to
which,
I don't
think that's his scariest debt, though.
In addition to which, yes, he has now got a bench warrant issued for his arrest because he has twice failed to appear in connection with a debt owed to the Mandalay Casino. Over $1 million.
I think the real question is, who would you be most fearful of coming after you, the Screen Actors Guild or Mandalay Bay Casino? I know which one I wouldn't want after me. And, you know, it's a significant debt and it's a couple $100,000 in interest. And, you know, the debts are all over the place. But when you stiff a casino or allegedly stiff a casino, boy, that's
scary.
That's really gambling. That's a bigger risk than making movies in Hollywood.
So will David Burstein turn up and go to court? John, we know who to ask.
The Magic 8 Ball.
The Magic 8 Ball. It's telling me ask again later. Isn't that one of its... I think that we will have to do that. And meanwhile, that is all the banter we have time for. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Recently, Nicolette Sheridan, who played Edie on Desperate Housewives, made headlines when she sued the show's creator, Mark Cherry, and ABC. Sheridan says Cherry smacked her in the head and behaved in what she called an extremely abusive and aggressive manner toward the individuals who work on the show. We're not going to explore the merits of that particular case today, but we do pose the question, what kind of behavior do employees have to tolerate in Hollywood, and when can they sue? Anyone who's worked on a movie or television show knows that creative people working in close quarters with unforgiving schedules can behave very badly. Screaming, tantrums, and sexcapades are hardly unusual, not just on the set, but in writers' rooms and even in the executive suites. So what allowances must be made for the creative process? And when does bad behavior cross a legal line, giving an employee grounds to go to court? There are no definitive answers, but we called on a couple of attorneys with expertise in employment law to give us some guidance. John West is a partner in the firm of Allred, Morocco, and Goldberg. He specializes in representing employees who bring lawsuits against their employers. On the opposite side is Adam Levin, a partner at Mitchell, Silverberg, and Knupp, who defends employers in such cases. Neither is involved in the Desperate Housewives lawsuit at this point, though Levin's firm has previously represented Disney, which is ABC's parent company. Levin was also lead counsel in a sexual harassment case called Lyle versus Warner Brothers Television Productions, also known as the Friends case. Amani Lyle was a writer's assistant on Friends who sued after she was fired. She said she'd been exposed to some very graphic sexual banter and even sexual pantomime in the writer's room. Adam Levin defended Warner Brothers and won a California Supreme Court decision that Lyle had no case because those raunchy conversations were not aimed specifically at her, and she'd been told when she took the job that things could get pretty foul in the writer's room. Many free speech advocates were pleased because a court wouldn't be deciding exactly what kind of language would be acceptable in the Friends writing room. But even if Lyle had no case, I asked Adam Levin, aren't there some cases where behavior does cross the line? What does a person have to put up with if they're on a television show or a movie and there's abuse? You know, we know about Christian Bale yelling and screaming on the set of a movie. You know, it's kind of a chestnut, the screaming, the abuse on the Hollywood set. What do you have to put up with?
Well, abuse is kind of a loaded term.
Sorry, counselor. Okay. What behavior do you have to put up with?
Well, the laws do not prohibit what you would call abuse or arguing or fighting or screaming or yelling. The laws are not civility codes. The United States Supreme Court has said that. The California Supreme Court has said that. The laws are designed to prohibit discrimination. And what that means in terms of harassment is targeted speech or conduct that's motivated by, for example, gender or race or religion. So if an employee is exposed to sexual speech, vulgar speech, angry speech, that's not going to give rise to a claim.
John, do you think that that's a little broad or is that accurate?
No, I think it's overly broad because conduct can be directed at a person because of that person's gender. For example, when was the last time a hypothetical director slapped a hypothetical male lead? When was the last time Russell Crowe got slapped on the stage? It doesn't happen.
Well, John, why don't you just give me sort of just the 101. What constitutes an unacceptable or hostile environment that would give rise to a lawsuit that might you could actually win?
Well, there are two components to it. One is conduct that is objectively based on sex, something that a reasonable person would find offensive. And the second is that it has to be subjectively offensive to the plaintiff, and it has to be severe and pervasive enough to essentially alter the terms and conditions of work.
Okay, so behavior that a reasonable person finds offensive based on sex that offends the person who's involved and is at the receiving end, and it is severe and pervasive. And I'm trying to get the distinction. And John's point of view is that it's a little broader than Adam as a defender of employers?
John's point of view is that if the plaintiff, the victim, perceives conduct as being offensive, that that may give rise to a claim.
Right.
My point of view, which I believe is actually supported by the law, is that the speech or conduct must be motivated by gender. It doesn't really matter whether the plaintiff is offended or not. What matters is the motivation of the speaker.
I don't think that the motivation of the speaker is the determining factor, nor should it be, because an innocent person can create the most offensive work environment conceivable based on sex.
All right, let me turn to the Friends case. And Adam, you were involved in that case, right? You were lead counsel in that case. No, and God knows, everyone who sits in the room with me here at Public Radio, which is not a TV sitcom writer's room, knows that I'm not shy about language or even imagery, and I have to watch myself. But I do have this image in my head of a woman sitting in a room with a lot of guys. And, you know, it's just really could be very unpleasant for her. So is that not actionable? John, I'm starting with you as the plaintiff's attorney.
Well, I would concede this much. You know, if the writers are preparing a biography of Dwight Eisenhower and discussing sexual preferences, I think that's clearly actionable.
What about this distinction between saying I'm writing a line for Mark Wahlberg in Boogie Nights or saying, you know, did you check out the lungs on that one about a woman who's also in the movie? I mean, is that a difference that you see, or does it just create, is the environment such that it inevitably, writing about sexual stuff also incorporates all sorts of chit-chat that's unrelated to the work at hand?
Well, the creative process is not a structured, linear process, as your question would suggest. It's not a matter of coming up with an idea about a biography of Dwight Eisenhower and then starting with, well, he was born on this day and here's his story.
Right. And we can stipulate that the creative process is a bit messy.
It's messy, and writers, as part of that process, are going to banter about all different kinds of ideas, some of which may offend others. But let me frame the issue in this way. There's an interview that Susan Stamberg of National Public Radio did with Nora Ephron, the writer of When Harry Met Sally.
More recently, she directed Julie and Julia. Yeah, just to update it a little bit.
And it really explains how these creative processes cannot be put into four corners of a room and cannot be boxed in any particular way. The story that Nora tells is how she and Rob Reiner were sharing secrets about men and women. And Nora said, well, women fake orgasm. And apparently Rob Reiner didn't believe it. And he called in other members of the writing staff and the production crew, female members, and he asked them whether, in fact, women fake orgasm. Now, I suppose John will say that that sort of informal survey about orgasms could potentially contribute to an employee's hostile work environment. Well, in this particular case, that somewhat unorthodox creative process led to one of the most iconic scenes from American film history.
Take it away, John.
Well, first of all, I think it fascinating that Adam has suddenly declared that in any creative environment, there's no such thing as a right to privacy. I suppose you're saying that any question can be addressed to any female employee as long as it's part of the creative process. I think that no court would recognize that as the rule of law.
So you're suggesting that somebody could have sued Rob Reiner and possibly won?
No, I'm not actually suggesting that because, first of all, from the sexual harassment perspective, a single incident that doesn't amount to a serious assault won't meet the standard for
right.
a sexually
okay.
hostile work environment.
It has to be repeated.
In other words, as a plaintiff's lawyer, you know, I'm not advocating a work environment where everybody dresses identically and, you know, and is completely sterilized. But I think it is a gross overstatement to say that you can't define when the creative process begins or ends. You can't box it in. You have to.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with two lawyers about when employees working in the creative Hollywood environment have grounds to go to court, alleging sexual harassment or other forms of abuse. John West represents plaintiffs who sue their employers, and Adam Levin defends the employers in such cases. I'm going to guess, Adam, if you are brought in, or someone who works with you, to, as happens, to counsel the employees of a show, you would probably counsel them, this is not quite settled law by any means as to what is and what is not acceptable. And therefore, would you not counsel them to avoid certain types of speech?
Well, I don't think my clients want a lawyer sitting in the writer's room
acting as some censor. I'm not talking all the time, but when you have your little sexual harassment seminar, do you not say to them, you guys, you know, it's fine, you should do this but not do that? I mean, what are the guidelines that you set?
The guidelines that are set are as follows, that as part of the creative process, writers should feel comfortable to express their viewpoints, to share stories, to talk about sex, religion, race, whatever they feel is appropriate under the circumstances. What they're not permitted to do is to direct comments or conduct at another employee because of race, gender, or religion.
And you totally disagree with that, John.
I disagree with it almost completely,
okay.
Yes. I also think that one of the factors that we've not discussed, it has to be taken into account, is what setting this discussion takes place in. And it may be that when the writers are assembled in the writer's room to generate a raunchy script, there's going to be a lot of sex banter that's part and parcel of the process. What about outside the writer's room? What about the corridor? Is this entire
right.
building going to be declared an official sewer with, where employees, and I mean employees
and
of both genders,
have no protection?
And I assume that extends
to the set also? Yes.
It extends to the set. It extends to the parking lot. Does it extend to the sidewalk? When the gate goes down, is that
well,
the point?
Well, what about it, Adam? Where
protection?
Does it stop?
Well, John's statement is based on the faulty premise that the law prohibits vulgar speech, and it simply doesn't. The California Supreme Court in the Lyle versus Warner Brothers case, and the U.S. Supreme Court, and many, many levels of appellate courts have stated time and time again that this is not a civility code. The laws are not designed to eliminate vulgarity and trash talk from the workplace. They're designed to protect employees from discriminatory treatment.
Drugs and prostitutes on movie sets. I assume Adam would say that could be part of the deal. I mean, or no, that's illegal conduct, right?
Well, I would look at it differently. I would ask the question, why are the drugs and the prostitutes on the set? Are they being done because anybody is a woman or because of anybody's race or because of anybody's religion? And unless you answer that yes, then there's no discrimination claim. Now,
that doesn't create what we would call a hostile work environment.
Correct.
John, you're not going to go along with this, are you?
No, I'm not. I think there are some other claims that might arise out of that situation, by the way, apart from sexual harassment claims or discrimination claims. For example, if an employee protests that illegal activity is taking place and is terminated, well, you know, the director has a creative need to pay prostitutes for sex.
Well, I have literally heard of situations with very famous movie stars where the movie stars required prostitutes and or drugs.
One thing I want to mention is that the industry, the motion picture industry, has never said that they're entitled to a free pass and that laws of general application, for example, laws against drug use, unlawful drug use, or laws against prostitution don't apply to the motion picture industry. To the contrary, they do. They apply everywhere. But the question that I was responding to is, do those things add up to harassment? No. Do they add up to discrimination? No. Could there be a violation of our federal or state drug laws? Possibly.
Coming up after a short break, we continue our discussion of when bad behavior in the Hollywood work environment crosses the line. To weigh in on the debate, go to the comment page for today's show at kcrw.com/thebusiness. Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Actress Nicolette Sheridan, formerly of Desperate Housewives, recently sued show creator Mark Cherry and ABC for allegedly making her life desperate on the set. We're talking about what's legal and what isn't in Hollywood's all too frequently hostile work environment. Our guests are two lawyers. Adam Levin is a partner at Mitchell, Silberberg & Knupp, where he represents employers. John West is a partner at Allred, Morocco & Goldberg and specializes in representing employees who have disputes with their employers. So, there's a quote in the book Indecent Exposure, which was about the David Beagleman scandal at Columbia Pictures. It's a very memorable line to me saying that the worst things they're done to people in Hollywood are legal and oftentimes involve contracts that they've signed. I'm wondering, do you agree with that? I may start with John as a plaintiff's lawyer.
Sure. I mean, I think Hollywood specializes, by the way, in crafting arrangements that are just outside of contract and just outside of legal enforcement. In my own experiences in the entertainment business, I see so many situations where business is done at the speed of light. People think they have an agreement that they really don't have. And at the end of the day, somebody in a perfectly legal way is done out of substantial benefits that in his own mind he was sure he was going to be getting.
Do you agree? Is that a Hollywood way?
And in terms of the quote, I'm not exactly sure what he means by that, other than I can say that the contracts are somewhat more common in the entertainment industry than in other industries, and they provide great benefits to the employees. Oftentimes, it provides them with job security. It provides them with severance.
Oh, we got an employer's lawyer here. Well, so in that case, Adam, can you say I waive my sexual harassment protection in a contract? Is that legal? Can you be asked to forfeit the right to bring a claim based on sexual harassment? I don't think so.
No, technically, people cannot in advance waive the right to bring a claim. But what has become more and more common is that employers who know that employees are going to be exposed to sexual speech or potentially offensive speech ask them on the front end to sign an acknowledgement that says, I, the employee, recognize that this is a creative workplace and that as part of my job, I may be exposed to nudity, I may be exposed to vulgarity, and I don't find that sort of speech offensive or unwelcome. And I agree it's a natural part of my work environment. And by signing that sort of an acknowledgement, it will make it ultimately more difficult for the employee to pursue a claim. But also, just as a practical matter, if somebody is truly offended by that sort of speech, it gives them an opportunity to pursue a different job, perhaps one working on Sesame Street.
John is shaking his head.
Well, I think it's just staggering to think that the entertainment business believes that it reserves unto itself the right to violate the law, because claims for sexual harassment and things of that nature are not waivable. And I think that to say to anybody that comes in the door, Mort the accountant, you're going to be counting beans for the next 30 years at our studios. But by the way, if we put pornography in your work stall, you know, you've got no claim, right? You're okay with that. To expect that to be enforceable is completely ridiculous.
Right. No. So I assume, Adam, then I could sign the document. Everybody could decide as part of the creative process that they were going to be nude for the day. But if somebody came up to my desk and said, I undressed for you, sweetheart, then I could sue them. Well, if he did it three or four times, not just once.
That's right. And John may have misconstrued what I said, because I didn't say it's a waiver. I said it's an acknowledgement. For example, on a production, you might have the crew that's going to be working with actors who are going to be nude, have the crew sign something acknowledging that they're going to be exposed to that nudity. Would you have an accountant sign it? That's debatable. But would you want the gaffers and the grips and the production assistants and the people who are actually on set to sign the acknowledgement? Absolutely. And while they're not waiving any claim, it is evidence that they don't find that sort of speech or conduct or nudity to be offensive.
So, I mean, would you say that, generally speaking, behavior in Hollywood is simply, unless it is specifically discriminatory, would you say that it's really rare for people to complain because it could terminate their careers? I mean, people are intimidated that they'll never, you know, it's famous, you'll never eat lunch in this town again. I mean, you know,
can
a lot
I
of...
take that one?
Well, I'm going to let you both take
She's
it.
So, at me.
Oh, I was not intentionally looking at you, but go ahead, Adam.
With
take
disgust.
It away.
So the, here's where the real problem is that people don't complain. And perhaps they don't complain because they're really not offended by
speech. How risky is it to complain? We all know that in Hollywood, creativity is like lightning in a bottle. And we know it to the point where you know, David Beagleman, when he ran Columbia Pictures, embezzled money. And this was a publicly held company, Columbia Pictures. They still didn't want to fire him because he had the mojo. He was making hit movies. So when you have a guy like that, and I won't go specifically to Mark Cherry because I know you don't want to address that case, but you, let's say you have that guy who brought you that desperately needed hit show, and I use the word desperate deliberately, a guy like that, who's going to win if somebody complains about that? Or a woman like that, who's going to win? We've seen it on sitcoms, that's to make it more gender neutral, where we had famous divas who were just doing all sorts of extravagant behavior. Who is going to win if an employee brings that complaint? And I don't mean legally, I mean in terms of just getting thrown out on your butt because you're creating a problem.
Well, from my experience, it's not in anybody's best interest to have a workplace where employees are in fear for their jobs or work under circumstances where they are unhappy or in terror. And I think John will agree with that. And so I think the industry has been very ambitious in getting people trained on what's permissible and what's impermissible and in implementing measures to protect employees from conduct or speech that crosses the line. Where the problem lies for employers, however, is despite all of those methods to complain, employees don't. And it may be because they aren't really offended. And what happens is after they are terminated, then you hear about it for the first time. That's when the demand letter comes that says, oh, well, this celebrity made all these very vulgar remarks, and if you don't pay six figures in 5 hours, this complaint's going to be leaked to page 6 of the New York Post. And some might call that extortion. And because the celebrities have their reputations to protect, some companies feel the need to deal with those lawsuits immediately and to settle them. And that's where there's a lack of balance in the system.
Now, I'm just going to have a hunch that John does not agree that the employers are the victims and the celebrities are the victims. But you go ahead.
On my end, I think we're uniquely qualified to answer your question because we get the calls from people saying, I'm an assistant director or I work on the set. And this particular individual, this director, this writer, this star has been heaping abuse on me constantly. But I'm afraid to complain. That is a fact of life. And the policies that Adam refers to, those are like movie sets. You know, you can walk up to a set of the Taj Mahal and it looks beautiful and magnificent. You press it with your thumb and it collapses. Those are those policies because they're not enforced because no one wants them to be enforced.
And then I would assume in many of those cases, you have to tell them they have no claim.
That's true. There is no law against being a jerk, and it's a community full of jerks.
That's our Hollywood.
Ouch. They're lovely people, actually. Many lovely people. But in every industry, there are going to be bad apples.
Okay. On this note, I'm going to say thank you to both of you, Adam Levin and John West. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Adam Levin is a partner at Mitchell, Silverberg & Knupp, where he represents employers. John West is a partner at Allred, Morocco & Goldberg. He specializes in representing employees who bring lawsuits against their employers. And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from J.C. Swadek. Matt Holzman is the executive producer of the show. Our theme music mashup was designed by beat architect Jason Groman. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. If you have any questions or thoughts about the show, write us at thebusiness@kcrw.com. You can also listen to this or any past program and comment about the show at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can listen to our podcast, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with the click of a button from our media player at kcrw.com. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.